So we're going to continue our study of Sefer Shmuel Beis with Perek Tesvav, chapter 15. And it begins the unfortunate story of the rebellion of Avshalom. We had spent the last couple of prakim being introduced to Avshalom. Avshalom was the avenging brother who avenged the rape of his sister Tamar, and he killed his half-brother Amnon. Then he was exiled. He was for 3 years. He was brought back from exile due to the intercedence of Yoav, the general. And he spent 2 years kind of being shunned by his father, the king, by David. And Avshalom was getting agitated. We saw that he tried to contact Yoav. In the end, he took violent measures in terms of damaging Yoav's field by setting it afire to get Yoav's attention. It worked. And Yoav finally got through to the king and got the king to meet Avshalom. We had said, our understanding of the last pasuk in Perek Yudalid was that even when it says that Avshalom came to the king, Vayishak Hamelach L'Avshalom, the king gave Avshalom a kiss, we saw that many understood that to mean it was kind of like ceremonial, and it wasn't full of such an embrace. And the fact that we don't hear anything about the relationship after that probably means that it didn't really turn to such a, it didn't become positive all of a sudden. So we begin with Perek Tesvav, Pasuk Aleph, Vayime Acharechein. It was after this. It was after this, after David officially forgave Avshalom. And you have to imagine that everything that has happened up until this point has colored Avshalom's perspective on the future, on where does he stand in terms of who's going to be the next king. Does he know about Shlomo? If he does know that Shlomo is the crown prince and he wants to change that, he's going to actively want to change that. We're going to see that there are differences of opinion amongst the commentators. How far did Avshalom want to take his rebellion? First thing we're introduced to, in addition to the fact that we already introduced to Avshalom's beauty, that he was very handsome, he was considered to be the most handsome, which on some level might be considered a qualification to become the leader, because with good appearance you'll have control a little bit to speak to the people. So the pasuk continues, Vayas lo Avshalom merkava visusim. Avshalom made for himself, he arranged for himself, chariots, a chariot, visusim, and horses. V'chamishim ish ratzim lefanav. And 50 men that would run in front of him. An entourage. He made himself look kingly. This looks very royal. This is not necessarily typical for each of the princes in David's kingdom to have. But Avshalom wanted that when he went around the city, when he traveled, he would have a posse. He would have a group, Merkava v'susim. So some want to see his focus on susim. So horses, in the general world, horses are considered to be power. Horses are a symbol of power. So much so that we addressed this in Parakhes when the people came to ask for a king. So we went back to Sefer Devarim, to Parshas Shoftim, Perek Yud Zayin, where the Torah has the Parshas HaMelech, has the paragraph that teaches us about a king. And one of the things that a king is not allowed to have, a Jewish king is not allowed to have too many horses, which means there's a drive for a king to have horses. What's that? That's a natural drive. The more horses you have, horsepower, the more powerful your kingdom is, and the more you believe in the power of your kingdom coming from things like horses, things like wealth, maybe even things like number of wives, and therefore the Torah limits all those things, because you as a Jewish king, you have to realize that your power comes from Hashem. But horses are usually considered to be power, right? We kind of compared that to donkeys. Donkeys seem to be the aspect of humility, and we pointed that out in Perek Tes when we were introduced to Shaul, he was on a mission looking for donkeys, that he was kind of focused on what's humble. And here we see Avshalom is putting a focus on horses. Rashi, very interestingly, if you have Rashi, you could see it inside your text. If you don't have Rashi, I'm going to read it. Rashi in Pasuk Aleph describes the Chamishim Ish, the 50 men, and he has the following description, which I have not academically checked what I'm about to tell you, but I'm going to tell you what I know, and then if you'd like to research more, you can. Rashi says, Kulam nitulei tchu. They all were missing, they had removed their spleen. the chukuke kapot raglayim, and the kind of feeling, the nerves that were on the bottom of their feet. This was a tactic, the Gemara explains in Sanhedrin, this was a tactic for runners. There was a type of potion, apparently your spleen slows you down. So there was a type, at least in an ancient belief, there was a type of potion that people could take that would kind of internally destroy the spleen and make you a quicker runner. In addition, you could do some type of surgical procedure, again, an ancient surgical procedure, to remove feeling from the bottom of your feet. So either it was removing something, or maybe it was just causing the feet to become so hard or callous that you would be able to run and you would not be, right? If you step on a rock, it wouldn't bother you. If you stepped on something a little sharp, it wouldn't bother you. You could continue your running. What's fascinating is that this, when the Gemara mentions this explanation of kulam tulei tchul kuke kapot raglayim, it's in reference to the 50 people who ran in front of Adoniyah. Adoniyah was another son of David who later on leads his own rebellion. So why Rashi chooses to adopt the Gemara to hear, I can't say for sure, but the stories are similar, that you have a son of David who's rebelling, and the Gemara does give a description about the runners, specifically telling that when you had people running in front, I guess you wanted them to be able to run fast, and so they would kind of condition themselves to be able to run fast. Take it for what it is. You know, I guess some way this could just be, you know, was Rashi saying it's the same? Is it some type of, you know, maybe Rashi didn't do it? I don't want to say anything that's not true because I haven't researched it. But if you would look up the actual Gemara, it's a Gemara being made by about Adoniyah.
So halachically, there's no issue with like playing around with body like this.
There might be. You know, again, if something was dangerous, so then you'd have one issue. Mm-hmm. There's another issue called chabala. A person is not allowed to cause a wound to themselves. Mm-hmm. So when a person needs surgery, so then obviously you can cause a wound to yourself because you're allowed to violate the entire Torah to save yourself. So if I need this surgery or else my life is in danger, I'd be allowed to violate Shabbos and Kashrus, so I could violate this idea of wounding oneself. When it comes to elective procedures, so then it's going to depend. When it comes to plastic surgery, it might depend. It might depend. Now in 2018, Poskim talk about psychological factors, right? You might have a young person, doesn't have to be a young person, but a lot of times it happens, they get an injury with their nose. And the nose doctor says, in terms of your health, everything's fine. But in terms of appearance, you know, you're going to look, based on the injury, right, or a burn victim, based on appearance, you're going to look a certain way. You'll be healthy, you'll be fine, but appearance can have major psychological factors that could also put a person into sakana. So then again, you deal with chabala. If this was, again, I haven't researched these things. If it wasn't dangerous, and, you know, in terms of the spleen issue, again, how they understood that you're going to drink this potion and it's going to affect your spleen, but not your liver and stomach and everything else that you need. So it's internal. So as long as it wasn't dangerous, there's no blood. In terms of the procedure on the feet, I don't know enough. But you're raising a good point. So he has this entourage, which, again, we all know, we, the readers, we all know what's going to happen. If you didn't know, I'm ruining it a little bit. Avshalom's going to have a rebellion. What if you're just a casual person in Yerushalayim? You have to read this pasuk for a second. You're a casual person in Yerushalayim. All of a sudden, Avshalom, he's been back for 2 years. You just heard the news that his father is now accepting him. And all of a sudden, he starts having an entourage. Is that suspicious? I don't know. He's a prince. He's one of the oldest princes, right? And now with the death of Amnon, he's technically the oldest son of David. Should David be suspicious when he hears that Avshalom has an entourage? I don't know. So therefore, but from Avshalom's perspective, all of a sudden people are going to start thinking about him as chashuv, as important. It's small. And we're going to see that specifically in the next couple of psukim, small calculated moves. Avshalom was a mastermind. He was a mastermind in planning this rebellion. And it's small calculated moves. So move number one is the entourage. Pasuk Beis. Pishkim Avshalom. Avshalom would arise early in the morning. Hashkama lahashkim. Rashi and the Radak, they say b'chol boker. He adopted the following practice: to wake up early every morning. Va'amad al yad derech hashar, and he would stand next to the entrance of the shahr, of the gate, either the gate of the city, perhaps the gate of the palace. And it had to do with the fact that near the gate, that would be a place of judgment. We say in Parsha Shoftim, in the book of Devarim, we say, Shoftim v'shotrim titein l'chol sha'arecha, that you should have judges and officers for all your gates. It used to be that the court would meet by the gate. There are two types of courts. There's the court of Beis Din that we discuss, and there's also the court of the king. People would come to the king to adjudicate matters outside of Beis Din, outside the context of the laws of Choshen Mishpat and Shulchan Aruch, what the halacha is. There's also the law of the king. The king can decide things, right? In the back of our minds, we know Shlomo and the famous case that came to Shlomo HaMelech. But David was also a judge. David acted as a king, and that's actually... that's one of the functions of king. So Avshalom would wake up early every morning and he would stand right by the gate. Vayihi kol ha'ish asher yelo riv lavo al ha'melech la'mishpat. And it would be that every person who had a riv, riv is an argument, a dispute, who's coming to the king for judgment. So he would meet Avshalom first. Vayikra Avshalom elav. Avshalom would call to him, vayomer, and he would say, from which city do you come? A very, you know, pleasant remark. Vayomer, and the person would answer, Me'achad shiftei Yisrael avadecha, your servant comes from one of the tribes. I come from so-and-so, I come from some such-and-such place. Now, presumably, this sentence, or this question of where do you come from, it's not... You have to imagine it's not the only initial question that Avshalom asked. It represents all of the niceties. Good morning, how are you, what's your name, where are you from, what do you do for a living, who you married to, who your kids are. Friendly questions. That is, Avshalom would reach out with friendly questions. Why this is the example chosen, I don't know. It could be that by knowing, we're going to see that Avshalom is going to sweet talk every person who comes to Yerushalayim. Every person coming, now you have to imagine, right? It says that Asher Yelo Riv, the person has a dispute. Anyone who has a dispute, you have to imagine that they're a little emotional. They have a dispute. Not only do they have a dispute, they've schlepped all the way to Yerushalayim. So for some people it's nearby, for some people it's very far, and they're about to go in front of the king, which has to be nerve-wracking, right? We kind of put forth the theory that even the wise woman from Tekoa might have been a little, you know, nervous in front of the, you'd be the most nervous in front of a king. And so asking where you're from, that may give Avshalom a little bit of an inkling. How far was the journey? How much do I have to sweet talk you? Do I have to take a nice cold soda out of the cooler? Whatever it may be. So this is the question that we're told.
He's also getting his name out to like all corners. Like,
oh, for sure. For sure.
Like, you know, they'll then say, oh, I met Avshalom, he was so nice, and you know,
100%.
And all of a sudden he'll have more of a following.
100%. But so far, is anything wrong with us happening?
No.
Avshalom woke up early. He wakes up early. The guy who's coming today does not know that Avshalom woke up early yesterday or the day before that. Today Avshalom woke up early and he happens to meet me and he's so friendly. Anything wrong with that? No. If the people in Yerushalayim know that he's out there every morning, so, you know, there are certain people, I'm sure you know, I'm sure there are people in this neighborhood, they walk every day. You could probably set your clock when they walk. They walk up Trenor at 9 o'clock in the morning, they've got their jogging shoes on. Suspicious about that? Not necessarily. But calculated. Mm-hmm. Pasuk Gimel. Vayomer Elav Avshalom, Avshalom would say to the individual, Re'e Dvarcha Tovim, see, or I see, Divarecha, your words, Tovim. Your words are good, Unuchochim, and they're proper. The Mitzvot Zion defines it as Tzodkim, which is like righteous or correct. Meaning, it must mean that one of the subsequent questions were, well, what's your dispute? What's your dispute? What are your arguments? How are you going to to kind of fight for yourself. And the person would say what they were going to say, and they would receive a compliment, right? Saying Devarecha Tovim Unechochim, saying Avshalom would be giving the person a pat on the back by saying, what you're saying is good and it's correct. But, and this is where you have a hint, or maybe not such a hint, of it being negative, Vishomeya Ein Lecha Me'ez HaMelech. Vishomeya, and someone who will listen, a listening ear, Ein Lecha Me'ez HaMelech. You're not going to find from the king. Which is...
That's undermining.
But it's also, it's not saying the king is terrible, it's just saying you kind of like, you might not, what you're saying is good. Now, not everyone is going to be judged fairly. Not everyone's going to be judged with the outcome that they want. But by saying this, it's almost like you could imagine Avshalom talking to one person from the dispute. A half hour later, the other guy from the dispute shows up and he has the same exact conversation. And he tells both of them what they want to hear. That you are right, your arguments are straight. It might not be heard so well by the king. There might not be such a seichel hayasher, someone who's so straight sitting in the king's chair. So that's why you might lose, because if you compliment someone and they lose, that bursts the effect of the compliment. But if you compliment and put the blame, if they happen to lose, on the king, well, then each person will walk out of the court, both the victor and the loser, thinking Avshalom is my friend. Now, if they talk to each other, okay, but that, you know, chances are Avshalom's willing to take that chance.
Is the king the only judge, or the other shoftim?
So in terms of people who are coming to Yerushalayim to be judged in this venue, we're only going to be judged by the king.
And no one else was observing this. No one else, you assume, there's no one else at the same gate.
You have to assume he's just doing it on the path before. This is very casual street conversation. If I was standing in front of your house and we're having a conversation and they're driving by, they're not going to worry. We could be talking about the weather. We could be talking about Shmuel. No one knows. Now, we know because it's being written down in the Navi. Nobody else knows. Vayom Pasuk Dalet. Vayomer Avshalom. Avshalom then said, Mi yisimeini shofet ba'aretz. If only I would be placed as a judge in the land. Ve'alah yavo kol ish. And to me, every person could come. Asher lo riv, who has a dispute, umishpat, and judgment. Vihitztak tiv, and I would judge him fairly. I would judge him righteously. Even in this statement, this is not a rebellious statement. He didn't say, I want to be king. What did he say? Mi simeini shofet ba'aretz. I want to be a judge. There are many judges. There's the king system, but there's also regular judges. I wish I could be your judge. I wish I could be the judge. But it's shofet ba'aretz. It's hinting as the judge of the land. Now, the judge of the land, there might only be one. That's the king. But it's not... It's not in your face, but it's subtle. Well, this is either happening somewhere between 3 and 5 years before the end of David's life, so we could presume he's somewhere in his 60s, somewhere in his mid-60s. Because the tradition is that David dies when he's 70, so this is either happening around 5... Again, this we don't know how long this... we're going to get in a few psukim to Pasuk Zion that's going to clue us into some age. So we'll discuss that then. But this is somewhere David's 60s, let's say.
Can I ask you a question? We assume from all this that still now at this late age in David's life, nobody knew Shlomo HaMelech was his heir.
We're not sure. Bathsheba definitely knew. We don't know how many people knew.
Of the time...
Presumably,
right.
Yeah, but we don't know how many people. We don't know how public
Nobody
it was.
Said it.
Perhaps.
But we don't know it from the text.
We don't know it from the text. Not yet.
He wondered if he's feeling, is he competing against his brother? Or is
right.
He competing
well, he
his
might
father,
be.
Or both.
Or both.
Right.
Now.
Or just because, I mean, because you could say,
if he knew, that's even worse, maybe.
Right. We're going to, it definitely gets hinted to, and it's something that we're not clear about. That this sweet talking that we just mentioned in Pasuk Dalet, where he says, "I could be, if only I would be a judge, and everyone would come to me with their dispute, vitztaktiv, and they would be judged fair. I would judge him fairly." He's almost making it sound. He's almost like promise. It sounds a little bit like he's promising victory to everyone, even though that's impossible. Every time there's a riv, right. If there's a dispute. So we were the business partners, and the business failed, and so we're suing each other. There's going to be a winner. There's going to be a loser, but that's only in practice. When you're sweet talking, you can make right. When you're running for office, you can make anything. Promises, right, about anything. Pazake. V'haya bikrav ish, and it would be when. When someone would come close, when a man would come close, lishtachavoslo, to bow down to Avshalom, after saying all these kind things, it maybe would be only natural to kind of bow down. Vishalachas yada. He would stretch forth his hand, the hechziklo, and grab the individual, v'nashaklo, and give him a kiss. The person is feeling like he needs to give honor to Avshalom, and Avshalom, in this brilliant approach, doesn't want him to treat him like he should bow down. He wants to see him as a friend. He wants to see him as someone who's there for him, someone who cares about him. So instead, he sends forth his hand to kind of stop him from bowing and to bring him into some type of embrace. V'nashaklo, give him a kiss. Maybe in the back of our minds, Avshalom. People might not know what Avshalom is talking about, but if people start noticing that people are bowing down to Avshalom, that's suspicious. So Avshalom, on the one hand, he's trying to engage the individual, and on the other hand, he's trying to not look suspicious to anyone who might be watching this. And it's right because this person is going. This person, what's Avshalom? What's the long game here? The long game here is that this person, who's from Shevet Dan, you know, one of the furthest tribes away. Is going to go back with feelings that Avshalom is there for me. And so that when a rebellion would be announced, and the person hears that it's Avshalom, it's that person who was so friendly to me when I came to Yerushalayim, the person will have much more of a chance of buying into the rebellion. Again, subtle.
Also, do we know anything? I mean, David as a king... He was liked and he was loved, right? Or were there issues at this point?
Well, we have a major question of, which you can ask it now, you could ask it once the rebellion actually happens. How could this be? How could Klal Yisrael buy into Avshalom? / how could Klal Yisrael, you know, sell out David? Mm-hmm. David, Malchus. I mean, think about David. If you stop a Jewish kid on the street and ask him to name one of the kings of Israel, every boy and girl is going to say David. So how could it be? So the main approaches are this rebellion, and as we'll see, many of the aspects of the rebellion in terms of what it involves is a clear punishment for the episode of Bathsheba. And so it could just be that Hashem is orchestrating it as a punishment, and that's why the people buy in. It could be that the knowledge of David's episode with Bathsheba has affected the people, and the people's belief in him as leader might be shaky. He might be able to get it back, but it might be a little shaky. You have to couple that with the fact that Avshalom, we have disputes amongst the Rishonim, how far did he want to take a rebellion? In Sefer Malachim, we have many rebellions, specifically in the Malchus Yisrael in the northern kingdom. Every good rebellion involves killing the sitting king. In order for you to take power, your best chance is to kill the sitting king and literally take his throne. Did Avshalom want to do that to his own father? That would be the best way to run a rebellion, but it's also killing your father. Did Avshalom just want to, perhaps Avshalom just wanted to secure the position, make David king emeritus, have him, you know, he'll be there, he'll be with him, but Avshalom will rule and David will just be retired. So it could be when people buy in, they're not necessarily, it's hard to imagine people would buy into killing David. That even if you want to say you're unhappy with how he's been king, but maybe they would be okay with the idea of David stepping down from the throne, which happens to me, in parentheses, that is what happens with Shlomo. Shlomo does start sitting on the throne in the last days, months, you know, I don't know the exact calendar in terms of David's life. So, and that's normal. So maybe that was, A, that might have been Avshalom's motivation, B, that might be the people's reaction. It's Pasuk Vav. Vayas Avshalom kadaver hazeh l'chol Yisrael asher yavo l'mishpat el ha-melech. Avshalom did like this to every Jew that came to be judged by the king. Does it mean every? It means, you know, he could have missed one. He could have, you know, slept late one morning. It means that this was constant. How long did this go on for? We don't know. But we have to imagine that if you want this to be effective, so you do this whole back and forth, this whole play, you do it 10 times, you've affected 10 people that might come from 10 different tribes, not so much of an impact. How long did it have to be? You know, we can all take our guesses. The result of it, the result, right, especially if you look at the way that we read the pasuk by pausing by the asnachta of El HaMelech, that this is what his approach was to do to all of Israel who came to be judged. The second half of the pasuk is probably the most, you know, exquisite, it's horrible, but it's an exquisite choice of words of the Navi. Vayganev Avshalom es lev anshei Yisrael. Avshalom stole the hearts of the Jewish people. He, right, everyone was in David's camp, and Avshalom stole the hearts of the Jewish people. For him to have done that, again, what the number is, if he did it for a year, so you'd be talking, you know, perhaps do 10 people come a day? Do 20 people come a day? If 100 people come a day, could he actually talk to 100 people? Wherever the numbers are, this had an effect where Avshalom, the Navi testifies about him, that he steals the hearts of the people. Many people will now no longer be loyal to David, they'll now be loyal to Avshalom. And from an outsider's perspective, from someone sitting in the city of Yerushalayim, again, it doesn't necessarily look so bad. All it looks like is Avshalom has started to travel with an entourage, and he spends a lot of time talking to visitors. You know, he would win the award for host, best host. Right, I never Lahavdil Elif Alfei Avdalos. I've never been to England. I've never tried to visit the royal family. But you can imagine, maybe once in a while, there's a member of the royal family that interacts with the crowd. Maybe they get in trouble by the queen. I don't know. But the idea is, you could have a royal that is more of a people person. That's Avshalom. That's to everyone else. We now know what he's up to. He clearly knows what he's up to, and you could imagine, this is not fact, he probably has some measure of his success, because he's waiting for a specific time to launch his rebellion, and it must mean that he's let people know that he has the entourage for long enough. He's done this tactic of waiting by the gate long enough, and now he's ready. We have a very strange opening to Pasuk Zayin. Vayihi miketz arba'im shana. It was at the end of 40 years. Which 40 years?
David HaMelech's reign.
So David HaMelech's reign of 40 years can't make any sense.
Because
he's alive and he's going to live for another couple of years. Now there's going to be another rebellion. And David only ruled. We saw David only ruled for 40 years. He ruled for 7/7.5 in Hebron. And then he ruled for 33 in Yerushalayim. So Vayihi Miketz Arba'im Shana, there are two main approaches. The most basic approach is it had to do with Avshalom's age. It's still cryptic because there are many ways of introducing someone's age, and this is not that. Now, we normally have a pattern that when we're introduced to a new king, we're told how old the king was when he became king, we're told how many years he served as king. A lot of times we're told who his mother was. Maybe there's some component of Avshalom is not going to be a king, But he is going to be in control of Yerushalayim for a short amount of time. He doesn't get listed in the, if you, you know, you look at the back of your art scroll, Tanakh, or that has all the list of all the kings. Avshalom doesn't make it in. But maybe there's some type of quasi where we're being introduced to him as a kingly figure, as a someone who's going to lead a rebellion to kind of take the position of king, and so we're introduced to his age. The other approach that the Mefarshim have is that Vayi Miketz Arba'im Shana, it was 40 years from Perechas, from chapter 8 in Shmuel. It was 40 years since the people first asked for a king. And kind of the divine, poetic hand is orchestrating that when the people ask for a king, we viewed it, right, the way that Hashem and Shmuel were both so negative about having a king, so they viewed it as a type of rejection. Hashem viewed it as a rejection of himself, kind of a quasi-rebellion, that the Jewish people were rebelling against Hashem by asking for a human king. And here, the human king is going to, who's David, is going to go through a rebellion against him, which we know is very clear as a punishment for what happened with Bathsheba. So,
is the transition from Shaul to David considered a rebellion?
No,
because he died, and then we needed a new leader. Was that
because David took the passive approach? It's actually going to be fascinating. We're going to see that David is almost going to adapt a very similar approach to this rebellion as he did to Shaul. Mm-hmm. And it's because there's commonality in that David is the one being chased.
By his son.
In one case, he's being chased by Shaul. Mm-hmm. In the other case, he's being chased by Avshalom. David is technically, outside of this punishment stuff, David is the victim. David did not deserve to be chased by Shaul, nor did he deserve to be chased by, meaning from a worldly perspective. So we're going to see that his attitude is similar. David also, we saw David didn't become king, right? The people of Hebron immediately recognized David as king, but everyone else recognized Ish-bosheth, Shaul's son. We saw in that 7-year period. We saw two approaches in the Mefarshim. We know that Ish-bosheth was really only king for about 2 years. So was it 2 years of him being king with 5 years of kind of vacuum of power? Or was it kind of people were unsure for 5 years and then Ish-bosheth was the last 2 years? But we don't consider that to be... Now, Shmuel did. Because if you recall, Shmuel was quite nervous when Hashem told Shmuel to go and anoint the new king. Again, Shmuel didn't know that it was David. This is in Perek Tez Zion of Shmuel Aleph, I think. Shmuel didn't know that it was going to be David. He just knew that he had to go to Beis Lechem, to the house of Yishai, and anoint one of his sons. He was very nervous because he said, if Shaul finds out I'm going to anoint the king while he's sitting, he'll kill me. And so that's when Hashem came up with the plan. Just say you're going to bring a carbon. You're going, right? It's normal for the man of God, the Ish Elokim, the Navi, to go and bring a carbon. So say you're going to Beis Lechem to bring a carbon. And while you're there, you'll speak to Yishai, you'll speak to his son. You'll go around that way, but there's a cover story. So Vayhi Miketz Arba'im Shana may be the 40 years since the people asked for a king. The Mefarshim explained this is in actuality this is taking place somewhere either 3 or 5 years before the end of David's life. So it's either in his 35th year of being king, his 37th year, he's 65, he's 67, he's somewhere along that age.
Can I just interrupt for a minute?
Please.
Is that like, you could say maybe David's the victim of all this, but in a way, forget about the whole Bathsheba thing, he sort of wasn't a very good father. And if he had maybe been a better father when his, daughter was raped, and after his daughter's raped, and then Avshalom wouldn't have been so angry, or maybe if he would have accepted Avshalom back and
it's complex.
Nicer to him. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
In my mind...
But Avshalom killed his son.
Right. No, I know.
Right.
What I'm saying,
he's not totally a victim.
He was a bad father.
It's complex.
No, his daughter was raped, and he didn't do anything about it. It's definitely not simple.
Jacob didn't do anything when Dina was.
Yeah, no, I know, but I'm just saying.
Was raped either.
where people say the leaders are not necessarily the best bodies.
Well, they may not have time, but whatever.
No, no,
but
it's also, it's hard, it is always hard to play 2018 psychologist.
Right.
Of parenting skills.
Right, no, right. I know, but I'm saying because Avshalom was angry.
Right, no, clear, definitely.
He was angry back then.
Definitely, and you have to imagine, as this is, I don't remember if we hear a lot from Yoav. You have to imagine that as the rebellion unfolds, Yoav is kicking himself in the side because it was Yoav's idea to bring him back.
Right.
And we had saw that Yoav, we explained one of Yoav's motivations is he recognized that Avshalom could be dangerous,
right,
and he would rather keep an eye on him. The only problem is it seems that Yoav didn't do a good enough job of keeping an eye on him.
Yeah.
Now, we know that David passes away at 70, and there's this whole, you know, Chazal have this whole interpretation that really David should have never lived. And Adam found out, and Adam donated 70 years of life. Now, 70 is considered to be a significant age in the Tanakh. Now, up until now, we have plenty of individuals who live way past 70. We have individuals who don't. Shmuel passed away when he was 52, and the Tanakh already described him as being tired out and old. It could be that if David passed away at 70. It could be that his 65 or 67, he did have an appearance of slowing down. He did have an appearance of aging. And if that was the case, Avshalom was using that. This was a time, Vayi Miketz Arbaim Shana is also an idea. Enough time had passed, right? They didn't have newspapers with pictures. But if anyone was aware of how the beauty and the handsomeness of Avshalom versus the aging David, who would you pick? Kind of, right? If you were picking it just based on looks, so Avshalom is young, right? If he's 40 years old, 40 years old is the prime, it's like
he's
the middle.
And
he's a prince, and he's handsome, and David might be aging. So that's just a fact. So what happens? Vayimi Ketz Abraham Shana. Vayomer Avshalom El HaMelech. Avshalom says to his father, the king, which means they're on speaking terms. He didn't have to go through Yoav. He didn't have to bend. Yeah, he can speak to the king. Elcha na, please, or I want to go now. Va'ashalem es nidri ashinardarti la'ashem b'chavron. And I want to pay back a vow that I vowed to God. And I want to pay that vow back in the city of Chavron. What's he talking about? We'll explain Pasuk Ches and circle back. Ki neder nadar avdecha, your servant, meaning me, made a vow. I vowed a vow. It's a verb and a noun. Bishifti b'geshur b'aram lemor. When I was living in Geshur, during my 3 years of being banished in the lands of Aram, I said as follows, Im yashov Yeshiveni Hashem Yerushalayim, if Hashem should return me to Jerusalem, home, Vavarti Yatz Hashem, I will worship Hashem. The way to worship Hashem is by bringing a korban. When a person makes a neder, when a person makes a vow, it's usually about a korban. And so Avshalom's story, his story to leave Yerushalayim, involves a korban.
Why Chevron? Why didn't he do that in Yerushalayim?
So first and foremost, if you're going to bring a korban, the best place to bring a korban would have been in Gidon. That's where the Mishkan was currently.
Mm-hmm.
However, we've explained this numerous occasions, but it's always important to review, that during the time, once the Mishkan was unfortunately uprooted from Shiloh, it lost its the semi-permanent status that it had. For the 369 years that the Mishkan stood in Shiloh, it had a semi-permanent status in that, number one, they actually changed the Mishkan. The walls were no longer the walls of Moshe Rabbeinu. Instead, they changed the wood, which has a temporary nature to it, to stone. And the walls of the Mishkan in Shiloh were made out of stone. But halachically, more significant is that during the 369 years that they were in Shiloh, no one could bring a karban outside of Shiloh. Shchutei chutz was prohibited. A bama, a private mizbeach, was prohibited. When the in Perek Dalet of Shmuel Aleph, when the Plishtim destroy Shiloh, and the Mishkan has to be moved, the Aron is taken and then brought back, and the Aron is separated. Now the Aron is in Yerushalayim. There was an allowance to bring a karban anywhere, including Yerushalayim. So there are two aspects to choosing Chevron. Number one is it's not Yerushalayim. He needs to be outside of the city in order to build momentum for this rebellion. Number two is that there's a lot of significance. David's kingdom began in Hebron. He wants to be the person who continues David's legacy. He wants to be the next king. He's recognizing that it's not going to happen unless he pushes the buttons. But he wants to kind of do it in the way, almost like his father did. It'll be very symbolic, right? His father became king in Hebron, and so he became king in Hebron. And that all, you know, all Malucha comes from Hebron. Hebron was the capital city of Yehuda. He's going to have, you have to imagine, or maybe not. I guess you could make, you could have the debate on both sides. You could either, now that I'm thinking about it, you can make the argument that Yehuda would be the least likely tribe to agree with Avshalom, because they're David's people. Or you can make it that they're the most, because they're also Avshalom's people. You could say that the other tribes might be more willing than Yehuda to recognize Avshalom, because David's slightly distant. He's from Yehuda. But if he can get Yehuda, well, then it'll, if he can convince Yehuda, then it'll go forward. If he can, so if he can be in Hebron and the significance, even the religious significance of Hebron, the place where the Avos are buried, you know, the mystics in Eretz Yisrael always speak of that being four special cities in Eretz Yisrael. There's Tzfat, there's Tveria, there's Hebron, and there's Yerushalayim. Up until this point in the Tanakh, you know, Tzfas is Tzfas, and Tveria is Tveria. We haven't even heard though. Maybe they're, I haven't memorized the names in Yehoshua. Did you?
No, definitely not.
She was learning it recently. So maybe they're mentioned in Yehoshua, but we haven't heard anything about it. If anything, the two special cities are Hebron. We have mentioned, Hebron's mentioned specifically in the Torah, and then in the Navi. So Hebron and Yerushalayim. So there's a semi-level of religious significance. Now, we can't do it. The most religious significant place would be to do it in Yerushalayim, but he can't. So he's choosing Hebron, and this is the story, the plot behind rebelling and trying to remove the king. So the cover story is a karban, which just happens to be also poetic, because we just mentioned before the cover story for Shmuel going to anoint David while Shaul was sitting was a karban. So it's ironic. Perhaps not on purpose.
He's doing it now after, I mean, he's been there for 3 years. Yes, David hasn't been speaking to him, but he's...
Well, we don't know how much more time it's been exactly.
But we know that he was there.
He was in Yerushalayim for 2 years without contacting David.
Because he says, he says, on my return to Yerushalayim. So
he
would think that
he
would have given the korban.
Right. What kind of story is this? I took a neder. I took a vow. And why hasn't he paid back the vow?
Right. It's been, so you got to say it's at least 2 years that he hasn't paid back the vow.
It's a good question.
All of a sudden now? I mean, this is when Yoav should have gotten suspicious.
Why should David fall for that?
Right.
Or Yoav also.
Anybody.
Right. Yeah.
And slash, why would Avshalom say such a thing? He seems to be so calculated.
Right. So there's something off.
Right.
There.
Normally,
we're missing something.
Normally, the way that a neder works, the way that a neder works is that if a person takes, people used to take nedarim to bring karbanos when like good things happened. Right, they'd have a good crop, and they'd say, okay, I vow to bring a karban. And either they would do one of two things. Either they would vow to bring a specific animal as a karban, and they would basically say, you know, Hare Alai, this is an ola, and I'll have to bring this as a karban ola. Or they would say, I owe a karban to the Beis HaMikdash, and when I get there, I'll find, right, they had a whole marketplace of animals. Not everyone schlepped their animal from where some people can't schlep an animal. You don't want to schlep an animal. You don't have an animal. You're a type of farmer that doesn't have any animals. You just have human workers. So the, normally what happens when you take a neder, I'm just strengthening your question. Yes. When you when you make a neder, you have three regalim to bring. The Gemara debates, is it three regalim in a row? Is it the full cycle that no matter when you do it, it's the end of Sukkos? Because the the year of the regalim goes Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkos. And once you reach the end point, wherever that end point is, so there's a prohibition called Baal Ta'acher. You're not allowed to delay, and you'd be in active violation. So why would Avshalom, you're almost asking, why would Avshalom kind of announce to his father that he's been in active violation for at least 2 years? Clearly it's been more, because 2 years is the 2 years of no communication. Now we have the whole plan of when he's meeting everyone by the gates. I don't know.
It's a good question.
It's a good question, because also, he technically could have just said,
"I want to go to."
I just have an outstanding vow. Right. He doesn't say when it's from.
Right. Or the reason. He gave a reason. I just want to go give a korban. My return to Yerushalayim, but he's been back, so.
Right.
And clearly, David doesn't find anything wrong with this because he tells him to go.
Right.
I don't know.
Gee, they
hated
us then.
Yep.
This is a side point which doesn't answer your question, but it does strengthen the Chevron point. So Rashi quotes from the Gemara in Sota that in Chevron they had fat sheep. So in Chevron it was known that they were good sheep. Shmenim. You can get a good carbon in Chevron. That does not answer your question. Okay. I think we have to leave your question as a question. Yeah. The amazing thing is that it works. The king buys it. David buys it. He's not suspicious. You want to throw in, you know, does Yoav know? Does Yoav not know? It's interesting that at least in this parak, in parak Tezvav, you're going to see Yoav is absent. Why is Yoav absent?
He's not even mentioned, right?
Why is he absent? We might not know.
He's rebuilding his fields.
We'll see. So what happens? Pasuk Tes. Vayomer lo hamelech. Also, just to note, right? Because I just didn't highlight it. When he's talking, when Avshalom is talking, right? Go back to the beginning of Pasuk Ches. Ki neder nadar avdecha. He's referring to himself in front of his father in a most respectful way, referring to him as king and referring to himself as Eved. So that, right? Because he doesn't want David to be suspicious. The best way is the same way he sweet talked the rest of the Jews. He'll sweet talk dad. Vayomer lo hamelech, the king says to him, Lech bishalom, go in peace. Vayakam, he gets up, Vayela Chavrona, and he goes to Chavron. Some explain when he says Lech bishalom, David was being a little sarcastic. Meaning, the last time you came and asked me to go somewhere on like an official royal trip, You killed your brother.
Right.
So now you're asking me again, go in peace. The ironic thing is that Avshalom is going for anything but peace. Avshalom is going for rebellion. And yet David is saying, Lech b'shalom, to go in peace. Chazal talk about the difference between two phrases that are possibly to be said. Lech b'shalom, to go in peace, and Lech l'shalom, to go for peace. And they seem to explain that if you're speaking to someone who's alive, you should say Lech l'shalom, go for peace. And if you're speaking to someone who's no longer alive, or you're speaking about someone who's no longer alive, you would say Lech b'shalom, to go in peace. And that there's some type of like foreshadowing here that this rebellion, right? I'm not ruining it for you, right? The rebellion doesn't work, right? We all know that Shlomo is the next king. So it doesn't go, right? And I said the art scroll chart doesn't quote Avshalom. Right. It didn't work.
Right.
So So Lech, and now there's a hint to how the rebellion ends. Lech Bishalom, to go in peace is considered to be something that you would say to someone who is deceased already. And David saying it here is... you could do some research. What's interesting?
Is there some nevuah involved in that?
There could, again, not without knowing. What's interesting is that when David and Yonatan part from each other, when David and Yonatan part from each other, Vayomer Yonatan le David lech l'shalom. David says to Yonatan, which is, this is the proper way, that, sorry, Yonatan said to David to go for peace, because David was, you know, David was going on to, and eventually, right, go for peace, two peace, but with the lamed, specifically with the lamed, as opposed to with the, right, the lishalom, as opposed to bishalom. So, to that, Yonatan followed the proper way to say goodbye. It would have been, and in that instance, right, it would have been interesting. It would have been interesting had David been talking to Yonatan. It would have been interesting what phrase was used. But in the story there, Yonatan stayed, and David went on the run. But he referred to David in the proper way. David went on to lead a prosperous life. Right. Again, you know, so if you want...
There wasn't one person who knew this distinction.
Right. Again, I imagine there's some who don't make such a big deal about this distinction.
When you talk about somebody who died, it's Olev Shalom. Isn't that what you say?
Alev HaShalom.
Ah, okay.
Or Aleha HaShalom.
Okay.
What that phrase means... I mean, I've been saying it my whole life because that's what we say.
Yeah.
What is that? Alav HaShalom upon, or Aleha HaShalom upon the deceased should be the peace? What does that mean?
What does it mean?
I don't know. I mean, well, that's what I think. I'm sure
and
he knows.
The Shammah should
knows
be
everything.
The peace, I think that's what it means. I think that you're saying like...
The peace on them?
The Neshama should be
on,
the
but
peace.
On them.
On them. Yeah.
On them
like
should
they,
be peace.
Yeah.
Right. The, you know... I guess you should, maybe you could, like...
Rest in peace.
Right, whatever that means. So we have Avshalom in Hebron, ready to launch the rebellion, and we'll pick up with that, Bez Hashem, next time.